Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Do you love freedom? Do you love being clean? Then you'll love Hero Soap Company, made in the USA. Chemical and fragrance free. A portion of each purchase donated to veteran and first responder charities. Initial subscription purchase is matched bar for bar and sent overseas to deploy troops. Let freedom clean. Hero Soap Company.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, I want to welcome to the show Charles Christian. Before I do, I have to thank C60 Purple Power. Of course, you've heard me mention it all the time. It's the amazing antioxidant. I use it every day. I feel better than I've felt in years. I have more energy. I've lost weight. If you go back and look at some of my older shows, you can definitely tell a difference. I feel better than I've felt in years. You should feel great, too. Go check out their website. Check out all the benefits for yourself. Click the link in the description or visit c60purplepower.com. If the link doesn't work for some reason in the description, you can always use coupon code KNOWLEDGE10. You get 10% off your order plus free shipping. Now, also, some important announcements about Forbidden Knowledge News. Please subscribe on lbry.com. The censorship continues on YouTube, and now we have our podcast platform that has been demonetized all of a sudden since December 1st. We have been unable to get any answers or responses from our provider, and unfortunately, this was one of our primary sources of income, is the monetization from our podcast. So we are trying to figure out what's going on. Hopefully we can get this resolved so we can start bringing in revenue again. But it appears that it could be another version of the censorship that we're seeing on a lot of these platforms, especially because our provider will not get back in touch with us. Now, the podcast is still running on all platforms, so you can still watch it. But we are hopefully going to get it resolved. We'll hopefully get in touch with somebody, but it's not looking good right now. We may end up have to build our own podcast platform, which would be the same thing. It just may take some time to do. In the meantime, if you guys would like to help in any way, if you'd like to leave a donation or just support our sponsors, that would be amazing to help us out during these times. It's hard for everybody right now. A lot of people are losing their channels, are losing their voices. The censorship is amazing right now, and it's not getting any better. And we really need to start standing up for this. And please support your independent podcast platforms. Please support any independent platforms. We will be launching our new website in January. Most of the content, of course, will be completely free, but it is just another way to get out of this machine that is censoring everyone and everything right now. So just please help us out if you can. I appreciate everything, all the support so far, and just support all your independent platforms because things are getting very crazy right now. Today, I want to welcome to the show Charles Christian. He is an English barrister and Reuters correspondent turned writer, podcaster, radio show host, an award-winning tech journalist, and sometime werewolf hunter, who now writes and talks mainly about geek tech, Americana, folklore, and the weird. Charles, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Well, and sorry to hear you're having the censorship problems there.
Oh, well, you know, it's on par with everything that's going on right now. We're doing our best to try and fight it. Hopefully we'll have it all sorted out. But yeah. I'm looking forward to today. You know, Europe is full of extraordinary history and folklore, especially England. Some of the most interesting folklore, things like werewolves and dragons, which we'll be discussing tonight, still, of course, influence pop culture and the way we look at our history and that area. Most people, of course, believe that our history was exactly as modern academia portrays and tells us in their textbooks. But I know that our history is much more interesting based on the many people and researchers that I've interviewed myself. And most of it is sometimes stranger than the fictional history that's portrayed on TV. And I love to hear about the different perspectives from different researchers. And I'd love to hear what got you started looking into this folklore and history.
Yeah, I mean, picking up on a point you make, there's an awful lot of supposition goes into history. And we just simply don't know what is the right answer. I mean, I'm sure you've seen these recreations on television where somebody's showing, here's a piece of pottery, and now we've only got this very small bit, but this is what we think it looks like, or here's a bone from a dinosaur, and from this one small bit, we reckon it looked like this. Well, how do they know? Where did they get it from? And as you quite rightly say, England's steeped in history. I grew up in a small fishing town that had a huge big ruined castle on the headland above it. I grew up with tales of smugglers, and there were strange parts of the house I lived in, tunnels that went nowhere and walls that swung back and turned into doorways and things. And so I naturally got an interest in history and weird stuff like that. And it really went on from there, you know, and it's that element of, well, where did this story come from? You know, and we hear this folk tale, but what was the source of it? Was there some historical event? And then when you start digging, you find that the historical events, the stuff you don't find in the history books because it's not, doesn't involve kings and emperors, is actually very, very, very intriguing and fascinating and just plain weird.
Definitely, yeah. I'd have to agree 100%. I think an interesting place to start would be the World-Newton Triangle and some of the Yorkshire worlds that you've written about.
Yeah. Again, it's a geography issue, but the Yorkshire Wolds are a series of hills just south of where I was born. And they're built on limestone. And limestone is unusual because it may look like a riverbed is empty, but actually the water's burrowed down beneath it, and there's water underneath. And then when you have periods of heavy rain, suddenly a river appears as if from nowhere. And say, with modern day science, we understand this stuff. But for people in bygone days, this would have been totally magical that, you know, first there's nothing and then there's suddenly water. But it was an area, I say, that was I grew up in. I had friends who lived in that area and they had tales. And what I suppose really intrigued me in that era, Sunday afternoons when you were a small kid, you were bundled into the car with your parents and your grandmother or elderly relatives and taken out for a drive because it was a treat, the Sunday afternoon outing. And we were driving across the Yorkshire Wolds one day in the evening. We went past a deserted public house, a pub, a bar. And as we went past, my mother said to me, back in the war, that's the Second World War, people got dispensations to go the long way around when they were driving munition trucks along this road to avoid going past that house at night because it had a reputation for being haunted. And that struck me as weird because, you know, there's a war on, there's a war for survival. We need to get munitions here and supplies there. Yet the authorities are allowing people to go the long way around just to avoid this haunted house. And you think, well, there was obviously something in it. Enough people were concerned about it and worried about it. And I suppose that was my first introduction to the weirdness of the place. And then I started much later on in life digging into it and researching it more and more. And the more I dug, the more weird coincidences and stories that sprung up. And looking at it geographically, there was a road that goes right through this area, and then there is a big natural maritime headland on to the east of it, and then the cliffs going on either side. So it did actually create a triangle. And I thought, well, always helps when you're naming an area to name it after something like a triangle. It always adds a little bit of mystery. And so it went on from there, and I wrote a book about it.
Very cool. Now, would you be able to tell us some of the stories around the triangle, some of the more profound and interesting stories?
Indeedy. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about an area that was populated a very long time ago. The earliest human remains and spits of building and go back 10,000 years. So in England, you're talking about just after the Ice Ages. So very early on, the buildings are wood. So there's just, but there's an old lake there. So the mud has preserved the wood over the centuries. And there was a discovery of lots of red deer. They call them frontlets. It's basically the front of the red deer skull where the horns are attached. And they'd all been carved and the horns made a little bit smaller and eye holes bored in the top of the skull, quite clearly as masks. And again, these are going back, you know, getting on for 10,000 years. So the thought is it was some kind of shamanism ritual that people of that time were practicing before they went out deer hunting, because deer were source of food, source of skin, source of sinew for strings and things. So, you know, it began very, very early on, the mysterious area about it. And there's an element of continuity. On one of the headlands, there's the remains of a Roman era signal station. So back to, you know, Imperial Rome. Yet only a few hundred yards away from it, when the Second World War started, they built a radar station. And even now there's a early warning station for now low-flying Russian planes flying over the North Sea. So there's this continuity of nearly 2,000 years of this same place has been used as a headland to warn against encroaching enemies. So it's sort of, you know, history in the past, but continuing through in the same way into the future.
Right. And you write about ley lines. It seems like a lot of these important areas, even megalithic sites and structures, were built on or around these ley lines. For those that aren't familiar, could you talk a little bit about the importance of them when it comes to the construction of buildings or sites, and even how they work with the, you know, the energy coming into the planet, and how these ley lines affect it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's three main views on ley lines. One of them, the totally skeptical one, is it's just purely a coincidence. And certainly in a place like England, where there are so many historical monuments, if you draw a line across a map, you're going to hit several of them. So there's that end of it. And then there's the earth mysteries side that believes they are forces of nature and there's power there. And then there's the more practical side that thinks, well, were these actually the equivalent of signposts back in a time with no maps, no literacy, for people to navigate around the countryside? And I mean, the simplest way to travel the country is to go in a straight line from A to B. And on tops of hills, because they're usually drier than down in the marshes at the bottom. And if you're trying to work out where to go, well, if you can see something on top of the next hill, that's something to aim for. So there is this element that a lot of historical sites in the United Kingdom.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Do seem to be linked by straight or straightish lines linking historical sites, hilltops, old burial mounds. In later times, churches have been built on them or castles have been built on them. And they all follow around. And in the middle of this area, the Wold Newton Triangle, there is a very large standing stone. A village called Rudston, and the stones now doesn't look as impressive as it used to do. It's got weathered and it's sunk into the ground, but excavations have shown that when it was originally put there, it would have been almost white in colour and it would have been the tallest standing stone in the entire United Kingdom, probably a couple of times taller than the main stone at Stonehenge. And that's in the middle of it. And if you draw one of your straight lines, a ley line, there is a ley line that cuts right across country and meets up with all the ley lines around Stonehenge and in the south of England. And again, another line heads up into the northwest of England. And on that line, it goes past various Neolithic, you know, Stone Age sites, standing circles, monoliths and the like. So there does seem to be something there that even 4,000 years ago when it was erected, was seen as magical and as important to the people. And particularly, again, they had to carve the stone, and the stone's been identified, and it's had to be dragged 20 miles across country in a time when they didn't have the wheel and didn't have the type of haulage equipment that you'd nowadays do it. Then it was erected and put upright. So again, a lot of effort went into it. So it's more than just people bored on a Friday night thinking, what should we do? Hey, let's put a stone up there or something. It clearly had a big, significant feature in the lives of the people around there.
Now, I know most of your research is around European folklore, but have you looked into the Nazca lines at all?
Yes, I have. I mean, not in any great detail, right. But yes, and I am aware of them. And again, they seem to have a similar function, that if you like, it was a sacred area, sacred geometry, sacred geography, that a particular area had a significance to the people, that they were prepared to make a huge effort. And again, the obvious point with the Nazca ones is they were all worked out on the ground. You know, nobody was able to get up above, high up, and say, right, you need to go a bit further along to make that wing look sensible. So again, it's that same thing, that there's a certain parts of the world seem to have some kind of magical appeal to the people who live there or are associated with it.
Yes, it definitely seems so. There are a lot of areas that it seems would have, now that, you know, modern science has kind of looked into it, these electromagnetic properties that other places don't have. So it's very interesting to see that some of those places with those properties see more of type of paranormal phenomenon or strange occurrences than others.
I mean, where we're talking about with the Wold Newton, with the limestone, that itself was perceived as being magical to the people who were there because it behaved in such an odd way. And the stone they brought out, it has high up, there are fossils visible on the top of it. So again, you've got this stone with relics of mysterious creatures from the past that would be unfamiliar to the people of the time. So it just adds a bit more mystery to it. But yes, there clearly is a feeling that that particular area is important. And it was echoed in over that sort of Neolithic period. They built large earthworks called cursuses. And they appear to have no logical function. They're not defensive. They're not for drainage. They're not for anything. It's just thought that they were somehow a sort of spiritual area. People would go and commit and carry out rituals. A lot of flint arrowheads have been found in the area, and it's thought that perhaps it was some kind of coming of age thing for youths, that they'd, you know, parade around when they'd become men and fire their arrows down these cursuses and march around. And again, there's several of them in the area, and the area is also full of barrows, the mound burials, and over several thousand years, and many of them were reused over and over again. Some quite clearly had high status individuals, chiefs or priests buried in them because of the archaeology that's being found. Others were obviously of some significance. But again, for an area that's relatively underpopulated. It was, you know, clearly where everybody wanted to be buried, or it was thought that this was a place to go when you were joining your ancestors. So again, there's another area of, if you like, spiritual significance to it.
Right. Now, I want to get into a little bit of our history that you don't hear about in your textbooks, and very fascinating parts of our history that I believe should be brought out into the light more. You've done research on the Queen and John Paul Jones. Now, for those that aren't familiar, could you give a little background and significance into your research into them?
Yeah, well, the John Paul Jones is obviously was one of the founders of the American Navy, and
it was during the Revolutionary War, correct?
During the Revolutionary War, and he was possibly a little bit on the, like a lot of people in that era were, dabbling in a little bit in privateering, sort of licensed piracy. So you not only sank the enemy ships, you also looted them. And he was on the Bonhomme Richard, and he was sailing up the North Sea, that's on the east coast of England, between us and mainland Europe. So he'd gone a long way. He was well into enemy waters. And he ambushed in just one ship a large convoy that was armed by, that was defended by two much larger warships. And a naval battle ensued that went on for about 12 hours. And they fired at each other and shot at each other until both ships were in a very bad state. And this was the famous bit where the English captain could see that John Paul Jones's ship was starting to sink and said, "Are you going to surrender?" And John Paul Jones said, "No, I haven't even begun fighting yet." And he and his crew actually then managed to take over the English ship and capture it, which was fortunate because John Paul Jones's ship did eventually sink. It's still off there. It's never been found yet. There's a vague idea in where it lies, but it's never been discovered. And so, you know, that was his great battle, the Battle of Flamborough Head, which is the corner point, if you like, of one side of my Wole-Newton Triangle, where it sticks out. It's an unmistakable headland, sticks out miles into the sea. And I say it was so close to land that people were able to, from the nearby towns, go to the tops of the cliffs and sit there and watch the battle in the distance. So I say I just found it intriguing that somebody like that, because I've always had an interest in naval history as well, this very significant battle that basically made his reputation took place just there in this relatively obscure part of the world. As for the Queen, well, the one of the Queens, it was Queen of Charles I, and she was there when the English Civil War was taking place. And there was a lot of fighting in that area. And she landed there in one of the small ports there and stayed there. And there was a lot of fighting and she nearly got shelled. And then she went to stay in somebody's stately home. And the story is that she, when she left, she pinched all the home's silver plate to go for the war effort when she departed. So she wasn't that popular. But,
yes, it's very interesting. I'd like to hear about some of your favorite places in history that you've actually visited. Just maybe run through a couple of your favorite, most profound places that you've visited that has some rich history.
Oh, that's a steep one, because where I am now, I move now to the east of England. That again is a area that's thick in ancient history, just with the old castles. I suppose for my fascination, it's always been the old castles and the old monastic ruins. There are a lot of them where I grew up in Yorkshire. Some huge, spectacular abbeys, which, because they were in relatively obscure parts of the world, they weren't immediately broken down and for their stone. They just stripped the lead off the roofs and left them. And they pretty much survived over the centuries. I mean, yeah, I remember going to a place called Knaresborough, which is in Yorkshire. And that's the home to Mother Shipton, who is a 16th century witch and seer who made a lot of predictions that seem to have been quite accurate. And there's a well there that drips a type of silica-like water comes dripping down, and the result is that it fossilizes almost anything that's put in front of it. And that was fascinating, just to see quite modern things that had been hung up there, and the water dripping on them sort of calcified around them and turned them to stone. And I suppose what really got me into the interest in the weird was went around Knaresborough Castle, and we were all lined against the wall of the dungeon, and the guide who was doing it said, when the sun came through that door, the prisoners would be shackled, and whoever the sun shone on first thing would be the prisoner who'd be taken out and executed that day. I mean, I think that's probably bunk in real times. I don't think they were that sophisticated, but as a kid, that's such an exciting story that, God, I'm just standing there. If the sun had been on me 800 years ago, I'd have had my head chopped off.
Yes, that's something that if that were the way they were to do it, it's very fascinating. Something else that's really interesting that you have researched and written about is the World Newton meteorite and the birth of superheroes. Please tell us about that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's an odd story, but in the end of the 18th century, 1792, 1795, somewhere like that, a meteorite came down in near a village called Wold Newton. And it was unusual because most meteorites aren't seen during the day or they land in the sea. This one came down and was witnessed by plenty of people, including a farmer who was not very far from it, digging a hole. And it came flying down, and he saw it, and the landowner took the meteorite and took it down to London, where it was discovered to be the largest meteorite at the time that had fallen in the UK, and one of the largest that had ever fallen in Europe. So it was quite an exciting thing, this large slab of meteorite, still in the Science Museum in London. And I say the farmer who found it,
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin Marshall credit card bill.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
He was a showman, and he paraded around as a major exhibit for a long time. But it was much later, and I was aware of that story, and there's a little monument to it, and there's even a brewery around there that makes meteorite ales and things like that. But it was much later, and I was reading Philip Jose Farmer, and in some of his books, he's created what he calls the Wold-Newton family, and it's basically his theory, which is obviously going into the realms of fiction, but it's again interesting to see that this meteorite from a relatively obscure part of England is suddenly the beginning of superhero theory. But he had this fictional history that on the day the meteorite landed, two stagecoaches were going past filled with ancestors of various people who would go on to be superheroes, or people like Sherlock Holmes, or even Moriarty, Sherlock Holmes' arch enemy. And they were all affected by the radiation from the meteorite coming down. And I just found that, again, this synchronicity, that it might be a small, obscure area, yet it crops up in fiction. And so many superheroes are supposedly descended from this one incident. And again, I just find that intriguing. And you think, well, what is it? Why did Philip Jose Farmer decide, of all the places that a meteorite could land, he'd pick that one and set it as the basis for the backstory for his superheroes?
Now, you also written about werewolves. I'd love to hear what got you interested in this, and what got you started researching werewolves.
Well, again, it's the Wold-Newton triangle, and when I was growing up there, there was a report, I'd be a teenager, that a lorry driver, truck driver, had seen what he thought were the red lights, the rear lights of a car parked on the road. But as he approached, he realized that actually they were bright red eyes of a large animal, which then leapt up at his truck, tried to get in, and he accelerated away. And he said it was like a wolf. And that prompted various people to comment that there used to be a legend of a werewolf around there. So again, I sort of dug into it. And there was a werewolf. Now, the thing about werewolves in England is that they aren't really part of our folklore. They're European. They have plenty of werewolf stories, but we don't tend to have werewolves. And this was an ancient werewolf story going back about 1,000 years. And it was said that a werewolf used to lurk in that area, and by day it took a human form, and it would go around markets, and it would see who travelers were and who were planning to move animals and livestock around. And then at night it would turn into a wolf and lead a wolf pack down, and they would attack the travelers, they'd steal their animals, they'd eat the animals, they'd eat the travelers. This was about 1,000 years ago, and the werewolf was said to lurk in an abandoned tomb in a nearby churchyard. Now, there were later tales about the werewolf, you know, it cropped up again in history. And again, this got me thinking, well, what was the source of the werewolf tale? Now, the area we're talking about did have a wolf problem back in the days when wolves were still roaming wild in England. And the wolds that we keep mentioning, they are high ground. And in winter, when it was hard winters, the wolves would come off the high ground and down into the valley below and attack the farmsteads around there, typically carrying away animals, but they'd also occasionally carry away people. And for people of that era, the way a wolf pack operates is, again, slightly magical. They appear to be able to signal to each other and move as a pack, as opposed to just wild animals running in all different directions. So there was a belief that the wolves just couldn't be normal animals. There must be some human guidance behind it, a sorcerer or something, a werewolf, a shape changer who was guiding them all. And as I say, the wolf problem was so bad that a hostel was built there for travellers on that road so that they could stay there the night safe in the hostel, not be attacked by the wolves. I say that goes back a very long time. But sort of then there's another layer on top of it that intrigues me, is that in 1066, which is the Norman conquest in English history, it was also one of the last attempts by the Vikings to invade England. And they landed at Scarborough, my hometown, and burned it down. Part of them in their fleet then sailed off to the nearest big river and sailed up there to meet the Saxon army. But another part marched overland down the valley, down the route that passed where the werewolf was said to have lurked. And with, you know, people who've read the Vikings, seen the Vikings TV series will know that there were a type of Viking called berserkers who thought that they were infused with the spirit of a bear and that they'd go into battle wearing a bear skin or, you know, a bear's skull or headdress on them, and they would be almost unstoppable. You know, they wouldn't wear a body armor, they'd just go hurtling into battle. And they terrified everybody they met. Again, it's now thought that as part of the ritual, they took various alcohol and drugs to build themselves, psych themselves up into this frenzied state. But I say they headed out there. But along with the berserkers who wore the bears, there were also the wolfers. I'm not pronouncing the Norwegian name very well, but they wore wolf skins and they were the same. They would go into battle marching with a large wolf pelt over their body and the wolf's jaws and head over the top of their head. And I just found it intriguing that at the same time there's tales of a werewolf, there is in local folk memory, people will remember the time the Viking army came through, led by people that appeared to be half man, half wolf, half man, half bear. So I wonder if this particular werewolf, known as Old Stinker, because apparently he supposedly had a very putrid breath, was partly a mixture of memories of the real wolves and memories of the Vikings who fought like wolves going through there.
That is very interesting. Now, through you know, common descriptions of werewolf throughout folklore and history, we have a human man that during the full moon or at certain times can transform into this wolf. Is this the common theme amongst all of the, I guess, English mostly folklore that you've come across, that it's an actually a supernatural event where this man transforms into a werewolf during a full moon?
That's certainly the sort of supernatural folklore version, that you are human by day and wolf by night, and typically when there's a moon shining. Some take the view it's more of a shapeshifter who has the ability to change his appearance so that he doesn't need the moon to do it. He can be a werewolf at night, a wolf at night, and a man by day, which I say is the one of the theories that people in 1,000 years ago had about the wolf, the wolves that were attacking the people in this part of Yorkshire I'm talking about. But definitely it's the shapeshifter element, whether it's caused by, I say, the full moon, or whether it's caused by the actual individual having that power to change and transform themselves. But yeah, that is the common theme behind it. I mean, one thing I have found when reading about up on werewolves is quite a lot of what we now regard as werewolf legend actually really only starts with the werewolf movies in the 1930s with Lon Chaney, The Werewolf of London, and I think it's The Return of the Werewolf, whatever, which has the idea that when you're bitten by a werewolf, you will become a werewolf, and that you have to be shot with a silver bullet, which is relatively recent innovation in bygone times, particularly in Europe, where they believed in werewolves and claimed they were a lot more common. In Europe, the way you killed a werewolf was the way you'd kill any large animal, you know, with guns or pikes, spears, or axes, or even there's a famous, well, not famous, but there's a picture, a woodcut you can see, 16th century, and a werewolf is being hung on a gallows. So you know, it wasn't a supernatural creature in that you couldn't, not like a ghost that you couldn't get hold of. It was a physical creature with a corporeal body, which could be killed as well. You know, if it bleeds, you can kill it. And so I say a lot of the legends are quite recent innovations. And again, in medieval times in Europe, when you killed a werewolf, it remained a large wolf. It didn't, as we do have in the movies now, miraculously change back to the human being it was. So I say there's a bit of a game where the ancient legend has got changed with modern legend, and we now sort of blur the two, in the same way that a lot of the what we now call vampire lore actually can be traced back to no further than Bram Stoker's Dracula novel. So you know, you've got ancient folklore and modern fiction, which have then 100 years later become modern folklore.
Now, here in the United States, we have people who have reports of seeing things like dog men, especially in certain areas. We have, I don't know if you've ever heard of Skinwalker Ranch, all kinds mm-hmm. of strange phenomenon, people reporting werewolf-like creatures and dog men. Are there any ongoing reports of these types of creatures or strange phenomenon in England during modern times, like around, you know, these times?
Not many. I say it's not really one of our traditions, the werewolf. I think one reason is because wolves actually were exterminated in England 500 plus years ago. So a lot of people have grown up that they've forgotten about wolves. It's not something you naturally think, oh, it must be a wolf. We do have at the moment, we get a lot of talk of, call them ABCs, anomalous big cats. And there are lots of reports of what seem to be members of the cat family, but far bigger than domestic cats, wandering around. And, you know, are they escaped exotic pets that people have put out to abandoned, and they've thrived in the wild? They are very constant across the whole country. In some instances, it can be easily explained that people haven't got the scale right and they think the cat was a lot bigger than it really was. But there have been consistently reports of these large cats wandering around, attacking livestock, leaving paw prints that seem far larger than you'd expect from a domestic animal. And the other thing we have is a tradition of large black dogs, called something like Shuck. We have one in where I live now called Black Shuck. And these, again, are far bigger than a normal dog. Some people have said they're the size of a small horse. They've got shaggy coats. And they lurk all over England. Sometimes they appear to be good-natured, and people say, you know, I was walking alone at night going home and it was spooky, and this large animal walked along by me and seemed to be protecting me. Other times they are out to attack people, and yet other times they're regarded as some kind of banshee, that if you see one or hear one, then you're going to die, and you know they're checking you out. I think they are, seems to be a relic of the Viking era, and the Vikings did occupy half of England for best part of 200 years. So we do have a Viking culture, and the Vikings have the hounds of Odin there as their dogs, extra large, and there's Fenrir, the large wolf that appears at Ragnarok at the end of the Viking sagas. So there is this sort of, I think, instinct that if you see a large, very large dog wandering, you might not think, oh, somebody's dog strayed. You might think, is that something from the distant past? Is that Black Shuck? Is this an omen of death? So I say, yes, we have the cats, big cats, and we have big dogs as our main creatures. We do also have actually our own version of Bigfoot or Sasquatch. We call it the Woodwows, and it's a wild man. And there are reports, and there still are reports, that of Woodwows is large human-like creatures being seen scuttling across roads and in wild parts of the country where, you know, there's large areas of woodland and not many people around. So I suppose those are our traditions.
Yeah, very interesting. I'd love to finish tonight talking about one of my favorite, either mythical or what we're told with modern history, is dragons. You know, I always wonder, did humans exist at the same time that some of these dinosaurs existed, and that is what we're calling dragons? Were there other creatures that were actually more along the description of dragons that we hear in folklore? What are your thoughts on dragons that are written about in folklore and possibilities of the existence of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you take the view that dragons might have been some kind of race memory relating to dinosaurs. You've obviously got the lake monsters, both in North America and in Africa, Russia, and in the UK, the most famous one is the Loch Ness Monster, which the theory is that they are some surviving little group of creatures that have the land, you know, that come from the land that time forgot, that have survived down the millions of years since the age of dinosaurs. So there is always that possibility, and I mean, we're constantly finding creatures that were thought to be extinct or that we didn't know existed, and you know, the exploration of the deep sea, finding all these creatures now living miles and miles down next to volcanic geysers and things, where you think, how can life survive down there in those conditions? So quite clearly, the animal kingdom has a lot more survivability than we initially give it credit for. I think also there's the fact now we're starting to see evidence that the human race, maybe not Homo sapiens, us, but people like the Denisovans and the Neanderthals, that they went back a lot further than we first thought and had a form of civilization. You know, they weren't simply ape men grunting and killing things, you know, the building temples, they were doing art, they were ritually burying their dead. So there was a form of civilization. So again, we're going, stretching back the timeline of the human race far further than we went before. So again, who knows whether they did encounter mysterious creatures that we now call dragons. And there's other explanations. There are a lot of creatures that were relatively unknown to the rest of the world and were mysterious, and you know, nobody had cameras, and it was largely word of mouth. You know, you take the first attempts of people to describe what an elephant looked like, for Europeans to work out what an elephant was. I mean, that's a fantastic beast. You know, the nose on it, the trunk on it, and the tusks, or the zebra or giraffes particularly. I mean, that's an animal that seems to defy logic. And then you've got the big alligators and crocodiles. Some of those are enormous and frightening, and they can move out of water very quickly, strike far quicker than you'd think an animal like that can move, kill them. So again, you know, to people of a couple of thousand years ago, when some of these legends of dragons were first starting to come out, these would be frightening, mysterious beasts. And then, of course, there's dinosaur bones. People were digging them up. We're still digging them up now. And if you found the skull of, say, a Tyrannosaurus rex, and you didn't know this is supposedly what it is, you'd think it was some kind of mysterious satanic beast of some sort of demonic entity. You wouldn't recognize it and be able to say, oh yeah, this was a creature that lived blah, 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 and became extinct 700 million years ago, whatever. You just wouldn't know that. You'd think, we found the remains of a dragon. So I think there's lots of different elements feeding it. Physical evidence, if you like, in the type of mysterious creatures like big crocodiles, dinosaur bones, what, for want of a better word, race memory, plus the fact that there remains this possibility of living dinosaurs that never became extinct. And of course, many of those over the last few thousand years may have subsequently become extinct, a bit like the way that we're killing off species all over the planet at the moment. You know, hunted to death, their habitat changed, they became extinct. And again, we don't know this because nobody recorded this information. So I think there's a lot of factors there. What I think is intriguing, though, is the fact that dragons appear to be almost a global phenomenon. You know, you have them in Japan, you have them in China, you have versions of them in India, you have them in Africa. You've got, you know, the Aztecs with their flying Quetzalcoatl and things, creatures. You've got them lake monsters in North America. They're everywhere. So it's not just some little local thing. Oh, this is a tradition, but only people in that country believe it. It's a global phenomenon. So again, there must be something there, because it wouldn't have permeated so far. It would have just withered.
What about the origins of the medieval type of dragon that we see portrayed in you know, TV like Game of Thrones and these modern movies, where they're fire-breathing dragons with a level of intelligence at times? Where do these tales kind of originate from?
I honestly don't know where the fire-breathing part came from. I mean, the tales go back at least 5,000 or more years. When you look at the tale of Jason and the Argonauts, the Golden Fleece is protected by a dragon at the bottom. And I mean, there you've got a common theme in modern dragon mythology, that dragons hoard treasure and gold. You know, it crops up in The Hobbit, the whole thing there, that, you know, the dragon is protecting its gold. So, you know, there's a common theme running through it. And quite clearly, there was a belief that there were some kind of big, scary creatures out there. As to the medieval depictions of them, again, you're back to the fact nobody had a camera, and people were making it up as they went along, and going from different sources. So they might know something about a crocodile that walked on four legs and had a big jaw, or they might have seen some other creature that ran on two legs and had that view. I think large bats, again, flying creatures fit in there. But where the actual model began, I don't know. And I say, it does raise the prospect that maybe sometime many, many, many thousands of years ago, there were these big, frightening, flapping, bird-like creatures with big hind legs and big mouths and big beaks running around the place with wings on. But I say, I don't know quite where you put your finger on it and say that tradition began there, because I say it's global, and you know, the Chinese and the Japanese, they've had a thing about dragons for thousands of years as well.
Very cool. Well, Charles, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Before you head out, I'd like to hear a little bit about your book, Creating Imaginary Worlds, The 12 Rules, if you could tell us a little bit about that before you head out.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon, and it's really for creative writing. So it's mainly for people who are writing fiction, but particularly fantasy fiction, science fiction, horror fiction. And it's really a number of lessons I've deduced from my own writing work and talking to other people, how to make the world that your fantasy creatures, fantasy world you're operating in, to make it plausible. And because I think we've all read stories where there's maybe lots of gadgets in it, but you can't really get engrossed in the story because you don't like the people in it, or there's implausible jumps in it and it doesn't make sense. And it's really just to make it consistent, so you do have this consistent world. And you know, one thing I always feel sorry for are the villains in a lot of these fantasy stories, because they're just bad, but they haven't got a backstory. Why are they bad? You know, everybody has something about them. They're one dimensional, and you don't really care whether they're bumped off or not. And same with the hero. If you know, I think we've all read books where you're going, I don't care, you know, let the dragon eat him, he's boring. It's really all about those things. Just, it's a very, very light read, very short read, and it boils it down into 12 tips. You know, don't have unfeasible last minute get outs so that you suddenly at the end of the story pull out a magical ray gun that shoots the enemy, because you haven't mentioned a ray gun earlier on. You know, keep it consistent, build up the world, and have some form of cohesion. And whether you're writing a novel or a short story, it's going to make the story far more attractive and engrossing and relatable for your readers. And say, it's on Amazon. And
Are interested in finding out more about your books and yourself, tell us any websites or social media, anything where people can find your work.
Yeah, my website is www.urbanfantasist.com, and my Twitter feed, where I'm probably most active, is also Urban Fantasist. And it's got links to my books. It's got links to the podcast I do. It's got links to other stories and things I write about. And that's my online home.
Very cool. Charles, thank you so much for coming on today. That was fascinating information. And I want to thank everyone listening. And until next time, everyone have an excellent evening.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.